funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
After a young, white, working mom named Venice Parker was dragged from a dark bus bench on her way home from work near Love Field in 1953, authorities couldn't find a single person who had witnessed her rape or murder. So why were they so sure her killer was a black man? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The incident put the whole city on edge, and District Attorney Henry Wade knew voters expected a conviction. So he gave them one, railroading the case of one Tommy Lee Walker through the courts, despite a mountain of evidence that Walker was nowhere near the scene of the crime when it happened. Less than 2 years later, Walker was dead, sentenced to die in the electric chair. Journalist Mary Mapes did extensive research on this nearly forgotten moment of Dallas history for her new D Magazine article, Who's the Real Killer? It appears in the May issue. Mary, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
Dallas was in transition in 1953. Set the scene for us. What kind of place was it for residents, and how much did one's experience of the city depend on the color of one's skin?
Everything. To a great extent, everything did. It was a small southern town on the way to becoming a big southern town or a big Texas town. It, at the time, had the same sort of healthy respect for business and authority that has marked much of Dallas's history. Henry Wade had been in office, I think, 2 years at that time and was beginning to get an iron grip on the city. He was a brilliant attorney, but he was absolutely incredible as a politician and as someone who could speak to people and gain their trust and confidence that he had the wisdom and authority to handle the criminal justice system in the city. And he really did rule it.
This is the same Henry Wade whose name was made famous in Roe v. Wade. This is the same Henry Wade who was present at the time of the Kennedy assassination, back when this sort of thing would have been handled by local jurisdictions.
That's our guy.
Mm-hmm. How did you find this story?
I decided, sort of as an investigative type, there are little puzzles and questions in life that obsess you. And because Dallas County had the practice for decades of saving forensic evidence, I wanted to see if I could find a case where there had been a wrongful execution that could be proven using DNA. I think we all, or if you study the death penalty at all, you have a very strong idea that this has happened, but we've never had it happen in this country that it's been proven with DNA, which is today sort of the coin of the realm, right? So I started going back through Dallas County cases. And I found a number of cases. I knew since I needed DNA evidence, it was going to have to be a murder that involved a rape or at least a rape. Because back then, until 1977, you could get executed for rape.
So you wanted a case that had DNA. Why was this sort of evidence kept before anybody thought of using DNA to prove guilt or innocence?
Well, the Southwest Institute of Forensic Sciences made this determination actually right about the time of the Kennedy assassination because they had so much evidence to process and because, I guess, at that time, in particular, the importance and relevance of that evidence had just been demonstrated, you know, wildly to the city and the country. So they started saving everything, and it's turned out to be a boon to the wrongfully convicted and unsettling, for those of us who wonder if we really are getting the right bad guy.
Hmm. Who was Venice Parker?
Venice Parker was 31 years old. She was studying to be a graphic designer. That's what she dreamed of doing. She worked at what we'd call a dime store. Now we have
like a dollar store, right?
And she did that every night or five nights a week while her parents watched her son, Joe. Joe was 4 years old. Venice's husband was in a TB ward, which was essentially a quarantining situation. He was not always deathly ill, but he had to be separated from the rest of society. That was how they handled TB at the time. And so she worked and took the bus home to save money.
And this one night, she sort of hopped across the street to get a bus that was coming sooner than the one she might otherwise have to wait for.
Well, she wanted to get this bus because it didn't have a stop and a bus change, which would have cost 5 cents more. Hmm. So she was trying to save a nickel.
So she was still alive after she was attacked and when she was found.
Yes. And, I mean, looking at the autopsy report and actually having someone with the medical skills to judge it, it appears that it was a very deep jugular vein wound, which would have really, you die rather quickly in those situations. So she must have been slashed and came running up onto the road where she was found within, 2 minutes.
So this guy who worked at the airport was driving by. I can't even imagine coming upon a scene like that.
Oh, can you imagine? He described her wound in court. This is a very 1950s way to say it, but it's quite eloquent. He said it was ghastly. And you can see from the picture in the magazine this month, she was a pretty, total 1950s young woman with floofy hair and a flowered dress and polished nails and red lipstick. And she was a good girl. She was a good mom.
So this airport worker takes her back to Love Field, knowing that then as now there would be a lot of police officers around. And gets there, and people sort of crowd around. What did the person who found Venice Parker report that she had been able to tell him before he dropped her off?
That when he went to her in the road, immediately he said, "Lady, what's happened?" And she was kind of crouched on the road, and he saw that she was bleeding terribly, and she said in a very hoarse, garbled kind of voice, "I was stabbed." And then he half walked, half carried her to the car, put her in the back seat, and sped off for Love Field. He said as he was driving, she didn't say a word, gurgling sounds. She made sounds as she was gasping for breath. And that she had gone into convulsions at one point, and he remembered seeing her feet hitting one of his back windows repeatedly. So she was dying, essentially.
But she gets to the airport, and a police officer named J.W. Gallagher said that he heard her speak clearly.
That's right. It was also interesting. No one else heard that, including witnesses, people at the airport. I actually interviewed a skycap who was in his 90s at the time when I talked to him, and he said she was dead. She didn't say a word. She was utterly silent. And this patrol officer said that he leaned in, and she coughed and raised her head and said, "A Negro took me under the bridge and did this to me."
That sounds difficult to believe.
Well, I think it is. And doctors who've looked at the autopsy report think it is, and witnesses thought it was. And just knowing how a person dies with that kind of terrible wound, it really is very, very unlikely. In his testimony, he actually went on to say some things that were really quite contradictory. He said that she said this sentence, "A Negro took me under the bridge." And then he said he asked her address, but at that time she could no longer speak. So she made like an O sign with her hands to, say it was 2009 some road. And he was cross-examined. How could she say Negro and within 3 seconds not be able to say O? Well, I don't know. So it was a really questionable testimony.
But it was enough at the time for White Dallas to think, okay, clearly the assailant here is an African-American man.
Yes. Yes, it was. It was enough for the police. It was enough for the prosecutor's office. And it was enough for the public. And at the same time the murder happened, there was this sensational series of crimes they called the Negro Prowler, straight out, roaring out of 1950s at you, where women all over Dallas were reporting a naked African-American man exposing himself in their windows at home. And it became like this fever throughout the city that if you hadn't seen the Negro Prowler, you just weren't living, right? So,
although race aside, and we'll talk about that, it sounds terrifying to,
Absolutely.
Look out your backyard window and see someone.
Of course it would be. Of course it would be. It still is when that kind of thing happens. But it appeared to have gotten a little out of hand in that the Prowler would be in like 7 places at the same time. And it really became women were afraid to be at home. There were men in groups patrolling neighborhoods with guns. And it was all over the front pages and just the talk of the town. People were getting guard dogs at the pound and gun shops were selling out. And so there was a lot of terror in the city. And then Venice was found, and the two stories sort of merged and turned into a great big Negro Prowler murderer story.
So there's no evidence that the Negro Prowler was the person who killed Venice Parker, but there's no evidence that it wasn't the person.
We have no idea.
Speculation.
Right. We have no idea.
You were kind enough to share with us some clippings that you used in your research and what the front pages of Dallas newspapers looked like in the early 50s is really astonishing.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Like every story is about race and about this sense
in some way or another.
Yeah, that white people had this sense that the black population was this menace.
Mm-hmm. Completely menacing. If you were a black male, there was no way you were anything other than a threat. And they would do stories about certain good Negroes, but only if they were helping white people do something. The language was so racially charged. It is just mind-boggling to think that you would put stuff like that in the paper. But they did, and that's the way people talked and the way they lived their lives. I thought it was really fun, which is, of course, a relative term when you're doing a story like this. But as a journalist, it was fascinating to see the difference between black newspapers and white newspapers and the different versions of the same world in which they lived. And they were mirror images of each other. I couldn't get enough of that. Dallas Express News, the Marion Butts newspaper, was absolutely fabulous and thoughtful and understanding in addressing issues of race in a very gentle, respectful way. While at the same time, we had screaming headlines at the Dallas Morning News and the Times Herald that were really dangerous.
And, of course, there was a good chance that members of the African-American population would also read the Times Herald and the Morning News. Very few white people likely read publications written by African-Americans.
Right. Mm-hmm. What would be in there for them?
Yeah. Tell us about Tommy Lee Walker.
Tommy Lee, well, there are two different versions of Tommy Lee. There's the Tommy Lee everyone knew until he was arrested, and the people who knew him previously continued to know that Tommy Lee. And then there was the Tommy Lee presented to white Dallas. Tommy Lee was 19 years old. He'd had a girlfriend for several years. She was on the verge of giving birth to their child on the night of the murder. She gave birth earlier the next morning, like at 2 or 3 in the morning. But he hung out. His family had a home near Exile Park, which is very near Baylor Hospital. And Mary Louise lived on the other side of the park. And his sister had a successful beauty shop there, Willa May. And his father was there. And Tommy Lee worked. He was working extra hours to save up money for the baby that he was eagerly anticipating and the wedding, because they were going to get married after the baby was born. And he would go to the park in the evenings, particularly the hot evenings, because you could cool off there, and sing. And he had a group called the Street Lamp Quartet. Two brothers were part of it, Raymond and James Beard. And I interviewed them as well. They were two of the people who were with Tommy Lee right about just before the murder would have occurred. And they were in the park 5 miles away from Venice.
And, you know, to hear that description of him, it's almost like a Norman Rockwell version of life in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
He had a job. It happened to be not too far from left field.
Mm-hmm. Denton Drive. Mm-hmm. He worked at a gas station. He changed tires and pumped gas and did all kinds of things.
How did he get home that night?
He rode home with a coworker, as he always did. Tommy Lee did not have a car. And so a coworker drove him home at 6 o'clock, typical. That's what he always did. Came home, had some dinner, went to the park, sang some songs, visited his sister in her beauty shop, and crossed the park and went to Mary Louise's house, where he sat from about 8 o'clock until 11 when he went home. Just to be with her.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Mary Mapes. Her article, Who's the Real Killer, is in the May issue of D Magazine. It's about the case that led to the execution of Tommy Lee Walker in 1956. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Mary Mapes, whose article, Who's the Real Killer?, appears in the May issue of D Magazine. It's about the case of the murder of Venice Parker that led to the execution of Tommy Lee Walker. This all happened in the 1950s. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Mary, we've established that Dallas did a pretty good job of saving whatever evidence there was. What was forensic technology like in the 50s? What did police use to figure out what had happened and who might be guilty?
There was really very little forensic technology, particularly technology. They were able to tell if a woman had been raped by using a photo light process. And as a consequence of that, they would be taking samples, and that was part of what was being saved. In many of these cases, they also saved clothing. They also saved, you know, if there were ballistic evidence of some kind that they had, they would save that sort of thing.
Was there physical evidence linking Tommy Lee Walker to this crime?
Nothing. Nothing. No blood, no bloody clothing of his, no knife. None of Venice's possessions were, you know, found with him. There was nothing linking him to Venice in any way. They didn't know each other. They didn't run in the same circles. They, you know, there was absolutely nothing. And Tommy Lee was not a kid who'd been in trouble a lot or who had shown a pattern of abuse to women or assault or anything like that. He was kind of just a kid.
What did the chief of police say about how he would go about his investigations?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, in many cases, I can speak most clearly on this one. Will Fritz was the homicide captain at the time, and he had been there for a very long time. I know he drove a big black V8 and wore a white hat. I mean, very Dallas. 1950s
Dallas.
He wore
a white suit a lot of the time, too.
Absolutely. Well, why not?
Yeah.
Go for it all. But they believed at that time that no one would confess to something they hadn't done. This is long before we understood that this happens, in fact, a lot.
Mm-hmm. But there are still people who don't believe that anybody would confess to a crime they hadn't committed.
I know those people. But it's absolutely true. A lot of the exonerations we see now being confirmed through DNA are of people who wrongfully confessed because they were scared, because they were tired, because of sleep deprivation, because they were so afraid of the police, because the police, they used to believe you could do as tough an interrogation as you possibly could. You know, hitting people and yelling at people was all part of questioning. And people had a tendency to confess with some of those techniques. And that was how they did their business.
And in terms of rounding people up to question, Will Fritz had this famous quote and said,
he said, "We have about 100 more Negroes to look at or talk to."
Not 100 suspects, not 100 men, not 100 whatever.
No. And he was referring to black men that they had some kind of contact with previously, or at least that was the assumption from the article. But they were, I mean, if you go through those papers, you see that they were pulling scores of men off the streets. You know, 36 picked up overnight and dozens released and you know, sometimes held for days.
So it took months for them to decide to target the investigation on Tommy Lee Walker. That it sounds like that suggests that they just weren't having any luck finding anyone who appeared to be guilty.
I think that was the case. They would, from time to time, come out in the paper and say, "We've got a live one, you know, we've got a real good suspect," and blah, 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 and then that would always fade. And they actually had arrested a number of white men at the same time to question about the case, which sort of gives further doubt on what the patrolman said about a Negro. So they were just, I think, at a complete loss. And the city was horrified. There were, you know, the police chief called out the World War II civil defense teams with their ham radios, and they were going all over town. Everyone was armed. Shots were fired on a regular basis. And one of the newspaper reports said that people were firing at sounds and optical illusions. I mean, talk about that is terrifying.
Yeah.
And so they got onto Tommy Lee Walker because as part of a robbery investigation, apparently long after Tommy Lee had left the Denton gas station, it was robbed. And so they, as was practice at the time, they got a list of everyone who had formerly been employed there, and they started going to those people's homes. And I think the first person's home they went to was Tommy Lee.
And Tommy Lee Walker was brought in for questioning. There was a confession that he almost immediately tried to rescind, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But we should note that 1954 was 12 years before the Miranda case. Was he even told that anything he might say would be held against him?
No, there was nothing like that.
He didn't have an attorney with him when he was questioned.
At no time did he have an attorney there. And his attorneys tried very hard to use some of these, you know, civil rights clauses to defend him, and it just got nowhere.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org. We have Chad on the line in Dallas. Hello, Chad.
Howdy.
Hi.
I have a comment and would like to hear your guest take on or response to. I just feel that a lot of people say, well, this is in the past, and it's done, and it's over, and the civil rights movement has happened, so we need to just move on with life. And I think until we go back and really look at and own what has been done by our society, that we are literally doomed to repeat it. There is still, in my opinion, a tremendous amount of racism in Texas and in the South and in the U.S. in general. And I think that people try to push it under the rug and pretend that it doesn't exist anymore because, well, we had the civil rights movement happen, so it's gone.
Well, I agree with you, Chad. And I have to say also, as someone who's lived and worked in New York City, that's one of the most segregated places I've ever been. So it is not strictly a Southern problem or a Texas problem. It's a national problem. And I think one of the things I found fascinating about this case is if anyone wonders where Black Lives Matter came from, it comes from centuries of this. And I really believe that, as you say, until we have a full and honest discussion about what happened, why it happened, who was wronged and who did the wronging, I don't think we can get past some of our knee-jerk responses. And I wish it were enough to say that we've had the civil rights movement, everything is great now, but I think you can look at Ferguson or Chicago or Eric Garner in New York City, and you can see that we're not there yet.
You spoke to a gentleman who was on Walker's defense team who is still practicing law
today. Incredible.
How old is he now?
91.
91. Tell us about him.
Kenneth Holbert. He was a fascinating guy. You have to imagine what it would be like to get your law license in Texas in 1951 if you were an African-American man in Dallas. And so he has all of that moxie and charisma and kind of hypercharged personality that you would expect from someone like that. And it's like, when you talk to him, it's like I've got 1953 on the phone. Hmm. I just love talking to him. He's very bright and funny. He is a lawyer at Housing and HUD, mm-hmm. and has worked there for 50 years or something. But he had a lot to say about the Tommy Lee Walker case. He's always been very blunt about it, that this was an innocent man who was executed. And the defense of Tommy Lee Walker was also fascinating because it was three African-American Texas attorneys representing a black man against Henry Wade, and it was sort of like the original dream team, and they put up the most ferocious fight they possibly could have up until the moment he was executed, but they couldn't save him. And Holbert says, at the time, you didn't go in believing you were going to walk out with your client. It would be a victory if you got life in prison, not death. That would be your victory. And that was all they were hoping for, and they couldn't get that.
Holbert said that the machine for convicting black men in Texas was vastly more efficient than anything in the Deep South.
Yes, he said it was Mississippi could only dream of being like that. That in Dallas, he said getting a conviction of a black man was like conjugating a verb. It was nothing. It was done.
Walker made this confession, instantly said, told anybody who would listen to him, actually, it wasn't true. I was tricked into doing this. What happened when he spoke to Henry Wade about this?
Well, he told Henry Wade, he gave Henry Wade a list of all the people who would testify for him, that he had been with them. He told them where he had been. He did whatever he could to convince Wade that it wasn't, you know, that he had, you know, made a wrongful confession. And Wade told him, look, I want you to sign another copy of that confession for my files. And, you know, in return, I want you to know I won't ask for the death penalty. And it'll also be very helpful if this confession exists for anyone who wants to help you in your case.
So signing a copy for Henry Wade's files was exactly equivalent to signing it and affirming that it was true.
Again. Mm-hmm. But this was a kid. He didn't know that. He had gone through, I think, 10th grade, but he didn't know that. And he had not been in the legal system. And he had no advice or counsel that helped him. And he just, he did kind of what he was told.
Not surprisingly, the jury in this case was 100% white. Mm-hmm. Was there any talk in the 50s about making juries racially balanced?
There was the talk about the necessity of keeping them white. So it was a subject of discussion. There was even at that time, Tommy Lee Walker's attorneys had pushed for black members on grand juries, and they couldn't do that. There was a scene at the Dallas courthouse where a black man was thrown down the steps when he showed up to try to be on a grand jury.
What kind of evidence was presented at trial?
The two most compelling pieces of evidence were the witnesses. These were two people who happened to be driving on Lemon Avenue at Shorecrest at about the same time. They said they saw a young Negro man there, and the language, again, is so loaded. Black men, it inevitably seems in trial testimony, they don't walk, they saunter, they don't stand, they slouch. I mean, it just is this really loaded stuff. But one woman driving by said she saw Tommy Lee Walker there, even though she was at a tremendous distance and it was dark and it was not well lit. Another man testified that he'd seen Tommy Lee Walker there, and in fact, when he saw him, had told his wife at that instant, there's a very good candidate for being the Negro Prowler right there. Hmm. And he ID'd Tommy Lee Walker. And that, in terms of evidence, that's it. That is it. And the rest of it is kind of smoke, mirrors, and racial resentment and fabulous lawyering.
Who testified in Walker's defense, or who was able to provide him with a credible alibi?
Well, he had 9 alibi witnesses, which is, you know, kind of mind-blowing. But the two brothers who'd been in the park with him, the employee who'd driven him home, his sister, a fellow worker at the beauty shop who had talked with him, his father, Mary Louise, Mary Louise's mother, Mary Louise's neighbor, and the ambulance driver who had picked Tommy Lee and Mary Louise up in the morning, early morning hours.
To go to the hospital for her to have her baby.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Let's speak now with Donna in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Chris. I am shaking with rage listening to this story. I am very grateful to the author for doing the investigation and writing the article. I just wish that more people would be able to hear this discussion, read the article. Texas, in the last couple of decades, has been writing textbooks that completely rewrite history. They whitewash history. Slaves are now referred to as migrant workers. The Civil War is now considered by 48% of Americans, not just Texans, Americans, as having been fought over states' rights. And slavery is considered just a little minor side issue. In the Texas textbooks, there's no mention of lynching. Thousands and thousands of black men lynched. No mention of lynching, no mention of the Ku Klux Klan, which, by the way, is a 501c3 corporation, tax exempt. No mention of Jim Crow laws, no mention of the lack of Miranda warnings and all these things. And I am outraged and I am shaking and I am furious.
Surely you felt some of that frustration as you
Sure.
were reporting this story.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what probably everything she says is absolutely, she's right. And I do feel a great deal of rage about it. But what I feel most is pain for both of these, Venice Parker's son and for Tommy Lee Walker's son. Those two men really have led reverse image lives. Both of them lost their parents horribly at a very early age, and it forever changed the course of their life. And, you know, when people do say stories like this don't matter, I always think back to Ted Smith, Tommy Lee Walker's son, who says, "It does matter. It matters to me." And Ted cries and Joe Parker cries every time they talk about this. And there is so much pain around this case that I think the only thing you can do is go back, take a look, do whatever you can to find the truth of the matter, even at this late date, and learn from it and go forward. And I do think it's really important to study where we come from, because it does tell us why we are where we are now and where we're going. It really does. And if we just keep looking forward, we're missing all the lessons that we should learn and really denying ourselves the depth of understanding of who we are as a people.
Have you encountered people who said to you, "Mary, this is 60 years ago, let it go"?
Yes, of course. But I'm rather stubborn. And I do believe it's a very important story, because we have an entire, a couple of generations of Dallas residents here who don't know anything about this. And I think they need to know about it and want to know about it. I mean, the Dallas I know is also a caring city made up of individuals who really do want to make a good difference in people's lives, who really do want to understand who we are and where we're going. And I think it's a wonderful window into where we used to be and how far we've come, I hope.
How long did the jury deliberate before convicting Walker?
Well, it's either just under an hour or just over an hour. Ken Hulbert says that he and the legal team went to a nearby restaurant, ordered a sandwich, and the bailiffs were there before the sandwich arrived to say there was a verdict. So it was not one of those long, difficult, 12 angry men sorts of juries.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Mary Mapes. Her article, "Who's the Real Killer?" appears in the May issue of D Magazine. It's about the case that led to the execution of Tommy Lee Walker in 1956. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org, call 1-800-933-5372, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Mary Mapes about her article in the May issue of D Magazine called "Who's the Real Killer?" If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mary, I'm not originally from Dallas, but I've lived here longer than anywhere else in my life, and I feel like I know a lot of local history. I knew nothing about this story, and I'm stunned that I knew nothing about a story that caused 5,000 people to show up and file past the casket of Walker.
Isn't that astonishing?
Yeah.
I was, too. I think one of the most moving things about this story was that moment, that two-day period. Walker was there in a small home-turned-funeral, viewing site in South Dallas in a cardboard casket. And more than 5,000 people came past. And Marion Butts published every single name in his paper. It was a way to show respect for this kid and for the black community of Dallas, that they were being treated unfairly, that this was an abomination, and that things had to change. In some ways, it was sort of just the early beginnings of "this is not working" for a lot of African Americans in Dallas.
What did Walker's son, what was he told about his father growing up?
Well, it's interesting. He childhood is a fog at times. One of the things he said that really fascinated me was that he thought his mother had told him his father was electrocuted, and he thought it was an accident, like he'd been working with wires or something, and it was an accident, even though his mom had told him from the time he was a baby, you know, they took your daddy away, they killed him, he was innocent, he hadn't done anything. But it was like all of a sudden it came together when he was about 10 years old and he realized what had happened. Really moving story, a sweet guy, married for 38 years, three sons, cries whenever he talks about this father he did not know, but feels the absence of so acutely. So it's really, he's a good guy. And I think this article, I talked to one of Tommy Lee's grandsons last night, Chris, Ted and Dora's son, and he said it means a lot to the family just to see this written here, these pictures, the story. This is what happened. You know, that was my grandpa.
So what can be done with this?
Well, there are a couple of things. When I met with Dr. Jeffrey Barnard, the Dallas County Medical Examiner, a few years ago, and I brought this case to him, and you know, I wanted to find DNA. He couldn't find any that had been preserved. But he raised a possibility that I hadn't even thought of in my wildest dreams, which was exhuming the victim's body to do another examination and see if he could get DNA off of that body that would link to a man who had sexually assaulted her. So that is a possibility. I talked to Joseph Parker, the son of the victim, this morning, and he says, I feel like my mother's murder is an unsolved crime, and I want to know, I want to do everything I can to find out what happened and to set right what happened. He's a lovely man who is really open to discussing this, open to the possibility that this had gone terribly wrong, and mentioned today he wants to speak with Ted. And I think the two of them will have, once they stop crying, because they're both so tender-hearted, they will have a great conversation. Nobody could talk to them the way they can talk to each other. And I think it'll be a meaningful conversation.
Yeah, it's so the way that their lives are inextricably linked is really
blood brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Jacob in Tyler. Hi, Jacob.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. So I have just a short comment and then a question. I've only been following this type of thing for about, you know, maybe 2 years or so now, but in the past couple of years there have been a number of men exonerated in Texas, some from death row even, I think. So that leads me to believe that there's a reasonable chance we've executed innocent people in modern times. And my question is, do either of y'all get the sense that there's any will amongst lawmakers or even the general public to, you know, confront that or do anything about changing that so that that's no longer, you know, an issue?
You mean changing the death penalty or changing the system by which we investigate these crimes post-conviction?
Well, I guess it would be both.
Both. Well, I don't know. I mean, as someone who's spent a lot of time on death rows around the country and death penalty cases, I have no confidence in it. Just because human beings are involved and whenever we're involved, something goes terribly awry every now and then. But I do think, ironically, nationally, Texas does very well in compensating victims of wrongful conviction. And that is probably because we have a lot of experience with it here. I worked with Michael Morton on his book, Getting Life. He's the man who was convicted and held for 25 years for murdering his wife, and he didn't do it. And then DNA showed he didn't do it. And then that same DNA showed a man had gone on to commit additional crimes almost identical to his wife's murder. And so you see what happens with a wrongful conviction is that whoever really committed the crime is out there doing it again and again and maybe again. So I think people, as they begin to understand that this is what happens with wrongful convictions, it's not just an immoral thing to happen to an innocent person. It puts us at much greater risk when we get the wrong guy. So I think it's tremendously important to get the right person. And I was just reading on the way over here, a case in New York City, a man was convicted and held for 52 years for a murder he did not commit. And he just got exonerated today.
It's hard to celebrate that, even though I suppose it's good news after 52 years. That's a lifetime.
That's a lifetime.
Do you think Henry Wade knowingly caused the conviction of people who were not guilty?
Well, I interviewed an assistant or associate prosecutor who worked under him, and he said, I don't think Wade would knowingly convict an innocent person, but, and here's the but, he would go all out. When he decided to take a case, he took it to the mat. I mean, he would go all out to win a conviction, the harshest possible sentence. He didn't pull his punches if he had doubts. He was all in, all the time, all the way, every case he convicted. Or tried, rather. And he, so I don't think in his head, I don't think he thought in maybe in terms of innocence or guilt. He thought in terms of, can I get a conviction or can I not? And he's not the only prosecutor in the country who's ever done that. That is a recurring problem in every exoneration. Edward Gray, the prosecutor I interviewed, he said, I call prosecutorial misconduct the perfect crime. Because you're not going to be prosecuted by someone who's in the same position you are. And we do have a lot of prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct.
How many Wade convictions have been overturned by DNA evidence?
Well, according to the National Registry of Exonerations, they say 25. And then they have this really fascinating kind of spreadsheet analysis of it so you can see all the things that led to that wrongful conviction, whether it was police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, false confession, bad eyewitness testimony, junk science, bad forensics. And some people had everything, you know, going against him.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Sean in Fort Worth. Hi, Sean.
Hello. How you doing? Love the show.
Thanks.
And thank you for the program. It's really amazing. I'm glad you guys are bringing light to the subject.
Thank you.
Oh, no problem. I guess I have a comment for those, not for the listeners who are listening to this and being empathetic, but more to the people who maybe aren't and saying it's old, it's in the past and everything. There's a woman by the name of Dr. Joy. You can look up her on YouTube. She has something she calls post-traumatic slave disorder, which is a play on post-traumatic stress disorder, of course. And it kind of makes the parallel of everybody knows what September 11th is. Everybody will remember what September 11th is. And that was one day in a really horrible day, a traumatic experience for a lot of people, even people, you know, in Europe who had nothing to do with the building are losing sleep, have psychological problems over this. And then when we look at slavery, you look at, you know, hundreds of years of this happening daily to a group of people. And every single day, they're getting their families ripped apart. They're having their children killed for scientific experiments, you know, kind of like the ones that would happen in Auschwitz and things like this. And to say that, you know, these people would, after 40, you know, 60 years or so, would just forget about all this stuff and that their collective conscience wouldn't remember some of the pains that were imparted by, unfortunately, by my race upon them is kind of insane.
Do you see that we are still living, Mary, according to some of the dynamics of the pre-Civil War era of slave and master in this country?
Yes, but I actually think post-traumatic slavery disorder is something the whole country has. You know, it's referred to as America's original sin. It is something that has colored every day of our history, the way we interact with each other, the way we love each other or don't. The way we understand who we are. And part of, I think, what's happened for white people is that we have had to learn to ignore it and walk away from it and not take responsibility for it. And I think for African Americans in this country, they live with the results of it every day. They see it in their families. If this had happened, if it had been a reverse, if white people had been held, I mean, I think we would then understand exactly what happened societally to them. But I do think you can see it when you look at a Trump rally and you see a Black Lives Matter protester getting beaten up. That person's bringing up something that those white people don't want to hear. And, you know, nobody wants to hear that your ancestors or your relatives did awful things. But I think sometimes you have to look at it and accept it and own it and, you know, do better.
It does seem like it's easier for many people who might have privilege that they don't recognize to look at a case that happened in the 50s and be comfortable discussing how wrong it was than to look at what's happening today.
I think that's true. I think people do feel that time gives them some distance from it, and I certainly had nothing to do with that. But I do think it opens the possibility that they will see parallels, in that case in the 1950s, some of the wrongful convictions we have today and some of the issues we have between criminal justice and mass incarceration of African Americans and that sort of thing. There is, you can connect the dots. And if you can look at Tommy Lee's case and it breaks your heart and makes you mad, don't forget to look around at things that are happening now that really are happening on our watch and that we have to pay attention to and acknowledge and, you know, own.
So it's certainly possible that if arrangements were made for Venice Parker's body to be exhumed and tested, that Tommy Lee Walker could be cleared posthumously. It really doesn't change anything except the record. What we'll probably never know is who killed Venice Parker.
Probably not. We probably will never know. But I think it might be really important to know who didn't. I know one family in South Dallas, it'll give tremendous pride to if they were able to walk out from under this cloud that they've been under their entire lives. I think that is reason enough, even if we don't know who did it. And there's always the wild possibility, you know, if you did get a DNA profile, if you were able to put it through, you know, I've forgotten the name of the computer system, if that man had been arrested and had DNA taken in any other crime or even a partial, you might be able to figure out who the person was. I also hope, it's very hard to do this with an old case, but it was a very singular sort of killing. You know, it was a stranger on stranger killing. It was at night. It was a sexual assault. It was terrifically violent. Have there been other cases like that in other places in Texas or in the country that followed that pattern? And I've done some looking for that, and I'm not having much luck with, because you can see from the newspapers, it's not exactly digital.
Hmm. Do you have a theory at all? Do you think it was a perfect stranger?
I don't know. I think it's really, you know, it's easy to look back and say things like, well, her husband disappeared after the murder, which makes me uncomfortable. Joe Parker told me this morning, he said, I'd really like to know who that realtor was who wanted to view the execution of Tommy Lee Walker. There was this one Dallas realtor who kept writing again and again, trying to get permission to see the execution. Appeared to have no connection to the crime at all. So there are little things like that that sort of tickle, you know, your interest. I don't know. In some ways, I think it may be sort of, it may be one of those kinds of crimes in the 1950s were unheard of that we've become very accustomed to now, stranger on stranger violence triggered by nothing other than availability and access.
Journalist Mary Mapes wrote the article, Who's the Real Killer?, that appears in the May issue of D Magazine. Mary, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.